Yeah, I don't know what's happened to our hardy troops here. Morning, 8 o'clock in the morning in Greek. Don't mix too well. That's one thing we'll have to really watch, and I don't know if I should give this exhortation now or wait till everybody gets here, but it's really important to, especially in a class like this where there's a need for the continuous, you know, approach to the thing to eliminate any holes in your understanding. To try to make sure you get to every class you can and get to a class on time. This is the hardest challenge you'll have. There's no harder class to do this with in the Greek in the morning, I think. It's been the history of it. But we really need to work as hard as we can on that so that we can come at it as a team and come at it as a group and really get into it as quickly as possible. Now, did I finish up exercise 15? I don't think we did. Okay, I want to... Right, we just gotten through the material in the text. So let's take a look at those last few exercises just to see how these possessive adjectives are used primarily. I think we did through 15E. I don't know if we did 15F yet, did we? Okay, we'll do 15F, G, and H, and then we'll move on a little bit here. 15F is dealing with the accented forms of the pronouns. And so, number one, the apostle sent me a slave, blank, doulon, epemson, ho apostolos. What do we want there? Emoi. Yes, emoi. We want the accented form here. They asked for accented form. So it could have either been moi or emoi. But emoi, dative form, because the apostle sent me a slave. In other words, the apostle sent a slave to me. Your slave there is in accusative case, so the me is going to have to be dative. Okay, number two, the apostle sent you, singular, a slave. What would that be?
Soy
with an accent. Yes, it'd be an acute accent. I mean, excuse me, a grave accent here because of the accented word following. But soy, sigma, omicron, iota. Number three, again, dative. Number three, the apostle sent a slave to me. Emoi, again. Yes, emoi. Now we're just using prepositional phrase with the same idea. Number four, the apostle sent me to a slave. Emme, right, emme. Accusative form here. Accented form. Accusative form because now... me is being sent. Okay. Number five, the apostle sent you, singular, to a slave.
Seth.
Okay, Seth, with the accent. There's no difference in spelling between the accent and unaccented form in this particular word, but the accent's the only thing that makes a difference. And this, again, all of these would have grave accents because of the accented word following, technically. Okay, 15G. Now we get into these possessive adjectives that we looked at last time. And these possessive adjectives, syntactically and form-wise, are just like other adjectives we've already dealt with. And their meaning translates as basically equivalent to the meaning of a genitive form of the pronoun. So let's look at these examples and translate these. Number one, didaske tus doulos mou. Now, what you're asked to do here is to rewrite this sentence. Instead of using the genitive form of the pronoun, use a possessive adjective. And they're asking for a first attributive position here. So that would mean then that what would our phrase here come out as using a possessive adjective? Yes.
Didaske tus emous doulos.
Tus emous doulos. Remember, emous is the adjective form, possessive adjective for my. And in this case, we're going to have omicron upsilon sigma because we've got an accusative plural masculine form. So it's just like any other adjective, we're putting it in first attributive position here, so it's going to come right after the article but before the noun. So tus emous doulos. Any question there? Okay. Number two, hoi mate tai su u nestuusin. Who would like to take that one? Rick? Yes, nestuusin. Good. Hoi soi mate tai. Okay. So instead of hoi mate tai su, with the genitive form of the pronoun, we're saying hoi soi mathetai, using the adjective form here, and this is not to be confused with the dative form of the pronoun soi. This is the nominative plural form of masculine for the adjective. And of course, mathetes is a first declension masculine, so we're having the omicron iota ending there. Okay, so sometimes after looking at all these pronouns, you hardly recognize a good old regular adjective again when you see one. Okay, number three, hokairosmu upo peplerontai. Peplerontai, excuse me. What we're going to do with hokairosmu, yes. Glenn?
Ho-emos-kairos.
Yes. Ho-emos-kairos upo peplerontai. Okay, peplerontai is a verb form we haven't seen yet. This means this is a perfect verb form. We have a reduplication of a syllable here, and it's pretty easy to recognize these. It's another thing to form them yourself, but we'll get into those later on, quite a bit later on next semester.
What does this mean?
Well, the whole phrase means upo is not yet, and peplerotai is fulfilled, and so it says my time is not yet fulfilled is what the meaning of the phrase is. And we haven't had things like upo yet. Those are little particles and adverbs and so forth that we'll be compiling lists of these in vocabulary and looking at them together a little bit later on. All right, number four. Eis tein didaskalion hemon egraphe. What we want to do now is see, we've got didaskalion hemon. We want to turn that into an adjective construction. So what will that look like? Any takers on this one? Okay, go ahead, Mark.
Eis tein hemeteron didaskalion egraphe.
Good. Eis tein hemeteron, hemeteron didaskalion. So that's we had humeteros and hemeteros. Hemeteros was our and humeteros was your, plural. And so we've got hemon here, so we want to have hemeteron, hemeteron. Alpha new, accusative, singular, feminine form of the adjective. Okay. Number five. Kata ton nomon hemon ethelesamen krinein auton. Getting a little bit more complicated Greek phrases here, things that we haven't seen yet, but they're still wanting you to try to pick out what's what here and figure out what to do. Now this hemon is the thing that's in question here. So what are we going to do with that? Turn that into a possessive adjective. Any volunteers on this one? Yes, Steve.
Kata ton hemeteron nomon
in Achilles men krinein auton. Yes, good. Kata ton hemeteron nomon. Hemeteron. Okay, again, using the form hemeteros. And this time we're going to need an accusative singular masculine form to agree with nomon. Okay, so omicron nu ending on your adjective, just as you've already normally seen. Now this little phrase contains some interesting things. This krinein at the end here is actually in an infinitive form. We haven't looked at those yet. And athelesamen is not unusual. It's an aorist first person plural form. So I think this means something like that. According to our law, we want him to die, or we want him to be judged. And so... And there's another interesting thing. This auton at the end here is an accusative form, but it's actually the subject of the infinitive. We haven't dealt with that yet either. Maybe I'm just throw a little tidbits out here to whet your appetite for what's to come. Okay, number six. Entonomo humon gegraptai. Okay, entonomo humon gegraptai. Yes, Glenn? Right. Entohumetero nomo gegraptai. Good. Again, humetero with omega with the iota subscript, dative form of an adjective. But a humetero, notice the upsilon there as the first letter. Only difference between hemeteros and humeteros is the first letter, so be sure to watch for that. And it's pretty easy to remember which is which. If it's hemon, it's humeteros, hemeteros, excuse me, and if humon, it's humeteros. So those go together. Any questions, any fundamental problems or questions on how to handle these possessive adjectives? Now, you're only worried about possessive adjective transformations in situations in which you have a genitive form a genitive form of the pronoun being used, because that's the only way you're showing possession, by either using a genitive form of the pronoun attached to the noun or by using a possessive adjective. And probably certainly the most common way is with a genitive form of the pronoun, but you will see these possessive adjectives, so it's important to know what they are. Okay, exercise 15H, same as 15G, but the possessive adjective in the second attributive position. Now, to do the same thing, only put it in the second attributive position. Hey, Christus mu de kaya esten. Okay, now this is a little bit tricky because he's throwing a third declension noun in at you. Hey, Christus is a third declension noun. We haven't seen those yet. But you can tell from the form of the article what we're really looking at as far as case and number and gender is concerned. So, from that information, you should be able to have enough to know what to do with your adjective. So what would this look like? Hey, Chris's mu would become then what? Rick?
Hey, Chris's, hey, M-A.
Yes, hey, Chris's, hey, M-A. Dekaias. Okay. Hey, Chris's, hey, M-A. Now, in spite of the fact that we've got an iota sigma ending here, this is a third declension noun, so your adjective is a second declension type of an adjective, second and first declension type of an adjective. So it's going to take first declension endings in the feminine, and it's just going to be like any other. It's going to be like, hey, kale, or like kalos, for example. Emos, kalos, what's the difference, you see, as far as form is concerned? So, hey, Chris's, hey, M-A. Okay. Number two, how tai asin hai entolai mu. Okay, we want to take hai entolai mu and turn that into a adjective form in the second attributive, yes.
Altai
asin high entolai high mi. Yes, high entolai high mi. High mi. Nothing unusual there. Number three, ho logos su alethea estin. Okay, how are we going to do, what are we going to do with ho logos su? Go ahead, Glenn. Yes, ho logos hosos. Ho logos hosos. Okay. Number four, to ethnosu kai hoi archieres paredokansa emoi. Okay, we want to do something with this to ethnosu primarily. Nothing else is going to really be changed. Yes, Steve?
To ethnos toson.
Yes, to ethnos toson. Good. Omicron nu. Again, we're dealing with a neuter noun here, and this is also a third declension, ethnos. We haven't even seen things like this yet, but it is a neuter noun, and somewhat debatable whether it's accusative or nominative here, because we're only dealing with a phrase, but it doesn't really make any difference. The form for the adjective is going to have to be omicron nu either way. Okay, in this case it would be nominative because we have the direct object as se. Yes, son, sigma omicron nu. Okay, prosu xomata uper ton adelphon hemon. Okay, we want something done with this ton adelphon hemon. Good old genitive plural, you don't need to really worry about it. Just omega nu's all across the board. That's just going to be ton adelphon ton hemeteron. Hemeteron, omega nu ending. Okay, and then the last one, eucharisto men dia tain piston hemon. Again, we're looking at a third declension noun here, tain piston, faith, and tain piston is going to then just take a repetition of the article tain and humeteron, alpha nu, humeteron. Gets alphas because of the stem ending in a row on this adjective. But the adjective form isn't going to change here. Now, later on, we're going to be seeing that there are such things as third declension adjectives as well as third declension nouns. And we're going to be seeing mixes back and forth where you may have a first declension noun with a third declension adjective on it, so you don't get the endings to rhyme. Or you may have a third declension noun with a first declension adjective or second declension type adjective, or the regular type we're used to, first and second declension type. But depending on the gender, it's going to get different forms. So we get lots of different combinations. After a while, you'll just hopefully begin to recognize genders and so forth without even worrying about whether they rhyme or not. But all in due time. Okay. Questions on any of this?
So
Yes, Mike?
That would be translated their faith, then?
Yes, right. Yeah, their faith. Faith of them or their faith, right. Or, excuse me, your, number six, you mean? Yeah, that would be your faith. Your faith. You masculine, I mean, you, not masculine, but you plural. Okay? Your faith. Okay. So the phrase is something like, we give thanks because of your faith or concerning your faith. Through your faith, we are made to give thanks. All right. Let's, any other questions on this, on chapters 14 and 15, per se? We're going to have a quiz coming up here, and probably a week from today is as good a time as any, unless there's any objections, unless you'd rather have it this Friday. Anybody rather have it this Friday than next month, next Tuesday? Okay, I didn't think there was. Yes?
I have a question on number four.
Number four. Okay, on 15H? All right.
Now, you said that this was song.
Right.
That's the accusative?
Well, nominative or accusative is the same form. Yeah, nominative or accusative would be the same form. This, in this case, it would be nominative because you have a verb and you have a...
You're saying accusative, and then you said
yeah.
Say was the direct object, which I understood.
Right, okay. Yeah, I started out saying accusative or nominative, and then...
Of a nominative, you got high and...
Right. Right.
What you
yeah, right. No, see, it is conjoined with something clearly in the nominative, so it has to be nominative.
It is a nominative.
Right. It's definitely nominative.
Mm-hmm.
But the form could be nominative or accusative.
Right.
It's only the context that tells you it's nominative. Okay. Good. I'm glad we straightened that out so you didn't try to figure it out in studying or something. No. No. We'll do some pretty funny things later on, but nothing that funny. Okay. Not that I know of. All right, any other questions? Okay, let's make this, let me tell you what will be on the quiz next time. Next Tuesday, a week from today, chapters 14 and 15. We'll do a little review at the end of the week before we take the quiz. But this quiz is just is going to be restricted only to chapters 14 and 15. It's not going to be a big comprehensive thing with lots of translation or anything. It's only going to be dealing with these pronoun forms and the hutos and akenos and the forms of autos there in chapter 14, and then the personal pronouns and related adjectives in chapter 15. So what I'm going to do is just ask, there'll be a few grammar questions about these. You'll need to know the paradigms for autos, akenos, hutos, and for the adjective, for the first and second person pronouns, ego and su, and hemes and humes, and then for these possessive adjectives. So all of these paradigms we had here, which are nothing new except for just a few unusual features of each one, and then I suppose the only real new thing would be on page 88, those first and second person forms. And then there will be some translation, but it'll all be from Greek to English. You won't have to do any from English to Greek. So I'll just tell you that right out, because I'm mainly interested in just reviewing these features rather than covering everything else we've had so far. So the vocabulary on the test will only be vocabulary that's drawn from the vocabulary two quizzes that you've had so far. So you won't have any new verbs or anything to worry about. And the focus won't be on verbs or anything anyway. It'll be on the positions of these adjectives and pronouns and so forth and how they're to be understood. So the translation part of the test will only be short phrases in Greek containing one of these adjectives or one of these forms, and the main focal point is be to understand what position it's in and what meaning it has. In other words, you should be able to tell the difference between the predicate and the attributive positions of autos, to be able to tell whether it means the same or the very, you know, that type of thing. And then just some grammatical questions. So you won't be having to go from Greek, from English to Greek. You'll just have to be in, I would review your vocabulary always, but it's not going to really be stressing that. I have to use some vocabulary words to give you anything to say, to put anything in Greek. So it'll be to a minimum. So this test won't be trying to probe for all kinds of other understanding. You won't have to worry about all your verb paradigms and all of that. The only thing you need to be concerned about primarily is chapters 14 and 15 and the data that's contained therein. And we'll do some review Friday or so and try to answer any questions that there be. So this is not intended to be a gigantic test. It's just a quiz on these two chapters, so we can kind of put them aside and get back into our verb forms where we have so much fun. Okay? Any questions?
Yeah.
That'll be Tuesday, a week from today. What's that date? The December 6th? Okay. That's Pearl Harbor Day? Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's the 7th. Okay. All right. Okay, let's look at chapter 16 then. We just got into that point in the textbook last time. And you can get an introduction into this whole realm of passive verb forms, which is not new, really. I mean, we have passive verb forms in English, but Greek does their passive forms differently than English does. And although there's a lot of parallels between English and Greek structure as far as conversion between an active sentence and a passive type of sentence. Now, this discussion is what we see in chapter 16 is important in many respects, and it has some implications theologically too. And it's important to know how in Greek one makes an active sentence into a passive sentence and expresses direct agency in the passive. There are certain passages of scripture that have been translated in King James certain ways. For example, Colossians 1:16, where it says, "By him were all things created." They've translated that as if it were a passive verb construction sentence, and it's not. And so it's important to understand what is what and what isn't and what the rules are, and to avoid certain confusions that can come and that can have some implications theologically. So let's look at chapter 16. Starting in section 111, we're reminded of some sentence structure types that we had way back before. And so going back to section 45, we find sentences 1 and 7 similar in meaning but different in structure. So he just repeats them here so you don't have to look back there. Number 1, the treasurer misappropriated the funds. And sentence 7 was, the funds were misappropriated by the treasurer. Now, these two sentences both have the same basic meaning, but they have a different structure. In sentence 1, we have the subject being the treasurer, and the verb misappropriated, and the funds is a direct object. In sentence 7, we have the funds being the subject, the verb being were misappropriated, now a passive verb form, and then we find the prepositional phrase, by the treasurer, indicating the initiator of the action. So we have two different sentence structures, although the basic meaning is the same. So in sentence 1, as we have seen, the subject treasurer indicates the performer of the action. And the object, funds, indicates the receiver of the action. And those are very common definitions that we've seen for subject and object, but as you'll see here, they don't always hold up. In 7, however, treasurer is no longer the subject, and funds is no longer the object. Even though the word treasurer still refers to performer, and the word funds still refers to the receiver. And even though the total information content of the whole sentence is the same as that of sentence 1, with perhaps slight differences in emphasis. So, different structures, same basic meaning, perhaps slightly different emphases, but same basic meaning. But now the roles of subject and object have kind of switched here. And we've got a different kind of a verb form. We've got a passive verb form, which in English is indicated with the form of the verb to be and then a past participle, but we'll get into that a little bit later on here. Now, section 112. The subject of sentence 7 is funds. This grammatical fact is indicated in English by the position it occupies in the sentence structure. Remember, it's word order that in English is indicating subject. So before the verb, in other words. It appears, then, that in sentences whose structures are similar to that of sentence 7, the subject indicates, but the receiver of the action. Moreover, in sentences with this structure, the performer of the action is indicated by a grammatical device we have not encountered before, namely by the object of the preposition by. So now we're seeing an unusual situation, really, in that the performer of the action, which we've normally associated with the subject of a verb, in this sentence structure, the performer of the action is the object of a prepositional phrase. And the receiver of the action is actually the subject. So in a passive sentence structure, the subject of that sentence structure is the receiver of the action instead of the performer of the action. So it's just the reverse of what we've seen before. Section 113, the relationship which holds between sentences 1 and 7 also holds between all sentences whose structures are similar to that of sentence 1 and the corresponding sentences whose structures are similar to that of sentence 7. So we can make a generality here. Thus, we can construct an indefinite number of sentences which are structurally similar to sentence 1, and for each of these, we can construct a sentence with the same information content but with a similar structure, a structure similar to that of sentence 7. So we can take any active sentence, in other words, any sentence with an active verb, a transitive verb with a subject and an object, and we can convert that sentence into a passive transformation by reversing the positions of the subject and the object, using a preposition to denote the performer of the action, and changing the verb form from an active to a passive form. All those things are necessary. So let's look at these examples here. This will get us ready for what we're about to see. We'll make some generalities as far as English and then turn this into a Greek discussion. Now, cats catch mice. Cat's subject, verb catch, mice direct object. We can revert, we can change, transform this into a passive sentence structure by saying mice are caught by cats. Now here, mice was our previous direct object. Now it becomes the subject of this new sentence. Our verb form has changed from an active form catch to a passive form are caught. And cats, which was the subject of our previous sentence, now becomes the object of a prepositional phrase by, which is indicating the performer of the action. The dog is chasing a cat. Passive transformation. A cat is being chased by the dog. So again, the same situation. Cat becomes the subject. The verb form is being changed to passive, and dog now becomes the object of a preposition. Yes. Yes, except that what you're really seeing there, it wouldn't be active. A cat is being chased in would still be a passive verb form, but you're having an unstated performer of the action. That's all that's happening there. You still got a passive verb form, and in Greek you would still have a passive verb form. You just don't have any stated agent for the action, or the performer of the action is unstated. So sometimes that's, in other words, if you don't know who did the action, but you know the action was done, you know, you just may give a passive verb form. Okay, but you see that it's still passive because a cat is being chased. You know, the cat is receiving the action of being chased, as it were, by something else. And so if you knew what that something else was, then you could make that into an active statement. Oftentimes the reason for using a passive structure is that we don't know who the agent was, but we know that something was done. All we have is one end of the action. We don't know what the other end was. And so, since you don't know what the other end is, you can't make that the subject of a sentence, but you can make the one who's receiving the action the subject, since he's a passive verb form. And that's very often situations in which you do see passive forms. And sometimes in diplomacy and so forth, if you don't want to come out and say who did it, you could say it was done, you know, and leave the, you use a passive construction and not name the offender or whatever. Okay. The merchant was selling coffee. Coffee was being sold by the merchant. Again, the same passive transformation. Notice in each of these sentences we have the exact same mechanisms for making the transformation into a passive sentence structure. Switching the roles of the subject and the object and converting the verb into a passive form. Now notice we're not changing the tense of our verb, because the first two examples we have a present tense. Well, one is progressive and the other one's indefinite. Cats catch mice, that's present tense, more of an indefinite aspect. The dog is chasing a cat, that's a progressive aspect in the present. And then our passives are still giving, are caught, is being chased, still giving the present. The merchant was selling coffee, that was past tense, so the transformation in the passive is the coffee was being sold by the merchant. So we're preserving our tense idea. And then the last example, the secretary will write a letter, there's a future form of the verb, but again we have subject, verb, object. Now in the passive transformation we have the subject now receiving the action, the letter will be written. We still keep the future tense, but we've got a passive idea now. Will be written by the secretary, using the prepositional phrase to denote the performer of the action. Okay, now, section 114, comparing the sentences on the left with those on the right, we find A, the subjects of the former are objects of the former are subjects of the latter. Okay, so what was the object in the first type of sentence becomes the subject in the second type of sentence. B, the subjects of the former appear in the latter preceded by the preposition by, or in a grammatical terminology, the subjects of the former are objects of the preposition by in the latter. Okay, so what started out as our subject now is going to become the object of a preposition. Not the direct object of the next sentence, because a passive verb isn't going to have a direct object. It's going to be the object of a prepositional phrase. That's important to remember. Because when we go to Greek, we're not going to be converting the thing that was in the accusative in the original sentence, or excuse me, the thing that was in the nominative of the original sentence into something in the accusative in the passive transform. It's going to go to the genitive, and you'll see that a little bit later on here, and why. Mm-hmm.
So you've never seen accusative form in a passive construction?
Yes, in a passive construction in Greek now, if you've got a passive verb form, you're not going to see an accusative form. Let me just give a little bit of caution there, though, because there are such things as deponent verbs that have passive forms with active meanings, and in those situations you might see what looks like a passive verb form having an accusative, but that's just because of the type of verb it is. There's also a situation in which you may have a middle voice form. In fact, this is one of the ways you tell that you're looking at a middle form rather than a passive. If you do see an object and what looks like a passive verb, some of the verb forms have the same form for middle or passive. The middle form and the passive form are the same. Not all of them do, but some of them do. And in those instances, you have to, one of the ways to tell that it's definitely a middle form is if there's a direct object involved. Then you're getting a middle idea. So it's kind of a complicated question once we get into it a little bit later on. But let's put it this way. You will not, if the verb form is purely a passive verb form, not a middle, then you won't see an accusative there with regard to that particular verb. Now, you may see a complex sentence in which you have several clauses, and you might see an accusative in the sentence, but it's attached to a different verb, not to this verb. That's another thing you have to watch out for, especially in Paul's epistles where he gets big long sentences and lots of clauses. You may see an accusative in the sentence, but it's with a different clause. Okay. Now, part C. The verb forms of the former are replaced in the latter by verb phrases containing forms of the verb, consisting of forms of the verb be. This is English now. As in examples above, are, is, being, was being, will be, etc., plus the past participle of the original verb, caught, chased, sold, written, so forth, as far as English is concerned. Now, in other words, in English, to make a passive verb form, we use a form of the verb to be with the past participle of the original verb. Now, you don't need to worry too much about that, because we're not worried about English right now, we're worried about Greek. In Greek, we're going to see something different done anyway. They're not going to use the past participle in the form of the verb to be. They're just going to use a whole new different set of endings for the verbs we've already seen. And we'll call those the passive endings. All right? So it's easier in one way and more difficult in another way. Section 115. Verb forms such as those in sentence 1, sentences of similar structure, are said to be in the active voice. Verb forms such as those in sentence 7 and sentences of similar structure are said to be in the passive voice. So voice has to do with whether the subject is performing the action or receiving the action. In the active voice, the subject performs the action. In the passive voice, the subject is the receiver of the action. That's the basic distinction. Now, in Greek, we'll also have a middle voice, in which the subject both performs and receives the action. That makes sense. Or somehow he's benefiting from the action. We'll look at that separately a little bit later. Verbs which have both active and passive forms are called transitive verbs. Now, another way to think of a transitive verb is a verb that can take a direct object. But you can see that that's really the same thing. You see, if a verb has both active and passive forms, then it must be able to take a direct object. Because, you see, when you go from an active form to a passive form, the thing that was your direct object in the active sentence structure becomes the subject of the passive sentence structure. If a verb could never take a direct object in the first place, then it could never be converted into a passive form because you'd have no subject for this passive form. In other words, you gave an example, the dog came home. You can't say home was come by the dog. In other words, in English, that verb is intransitive. It doesn't take direct objects. And so it can't be converted backwards, because you wouldn't have a subject for it if you tried to convert it into a passive transformation. You've got to have a subject for verbs. You may not always have an object, but you've got to have a subject. And so those statements are really the same thing. To say that a verb has both active and passive forms is basically the same as saying that a verb can take a direct object. That's what we mean by a transitive verb, a verb that can take a direct object. Now, it doesn't mean that it has a direct object in a given sense, but it can take one. Yes? That would be more an adverb. That would be considered an adverb of, you know, a place or something like this, rather than a direct object. Huh? Well, in... Yes, well, in Greek, you'll see that adverbs often will look like dative forms. So you could even consider it, you know, that wouldn't be a problem to consider it a dative form. It's just going to depend on the idiom of a language. I think in English, they would analyze that as an adverb. And in Greek, you might actually see it as a dative form of the verb, of the word for house or something. That would be appropriate for something like that. But again, it's not a direct object. It's not accusative, for example. It won't be accusative. Okay. Now in section 116, we're going to generalize all of this and use a little bit of formula analysis here so we can see how to make these transformations and then transfer all this over into Greek structure. In general, if we let X represent treasurer, cats, dog, merchant, secretary, etc., or the subject of any other sentence whose structure is similar to that of sentence 1, and if we let Y represent funds, mice, cat, coffee, letters, so forth, any object or the object of any other sentence whose structure is similar to that of sentence 1, we can then represent sentence 1 itself and all sentences similar to that structure, of similar structure, by the formula X sub S, V active, and Y sub 0. Now the S is indicating subject. So X meaning subject, verb active verb form, and then Y with the O indicating object. So we have subject, verb, object, same basic sentence structure we looked at before. Now though, because we're interested in making passive transformations, we're labeling it with X and Y so we can see what happens to X and Y when the transformation takes place. You'll see the reason for this terminology in a moment. So when subscripts S and O indicate that X and Y are subject and object respectively, and in the sentence structure, V active is a verb in the active voice. Now, sentence 7, on the other hand, as well as any other sentence of similar structure, can be represented by the formula Y sub S, V passive, by the preposition plus X sub 0. Notice that X and Y have reverse places here. In other words, if we're using X to represent the subject of an active sentence, then in a passive sentence, that is going to become the object of the preposition. And if we used Y to indicate the direct object of an active sentence, Y is now going to have to be shifted over to become the subject of our passive sentence structure. So now we have Y sub S. Y is now the subject. The verb is no longer active, it's passive. We have the preposition by, and then we have the object of the preposition, X sub 0, and that O there indicates object of the preposition, not direct object. And so the rest of this just explains that terminology. Now, we can talk about how to convert one to the other. So section 117, formula A can obviously be changed and transformed into formula B by A, moving X from subject position to a position after by. Note that by is the only new constituent. It's the only new thing you've added is the word by. B, moving Y from object position to subject position. So Y that was your direct object now becomes the subject of the new sentence. C, changing the verb from active to passive. Note that the verb is the only element which is changed in form. So that in English sentence, only the verb is getting a change in form. The subject and object don't change form because in English we don't have case endings on them, at least not for nominal elements. We will find that in English, with pronouns, there will be a change in the form. That'll come up here a little bit later on. But as far as nominal elements, words that you know, nouns, full nouns, they're not going to change their form. In Greek, of course, you can expect something else. They are going to change the form. In Greek, just about everything changes its form. Okay. Now, this transformation may be represented symbolically as follows. So look at these symbols. The first on the left side of the equation, you have the active form, X sub S, V active, Y sub 0. And then on the other side, you have the passive form, y sub s, v passive, the word by, and x sub 0. And then you have dotted lines connecting the various elements that are common to each one, or what happens to them. You can see over here this x sub s is connected in dotted lines to the x sub 0 on the other side. So basically you're pulling that over and sticking that at the end of the sentence after the preposition by in order to convert to passive. The v active is converted to a v passive. And the y sub 0 is converted to y sub s. It's changed from an object position to a subject position, in other words. So that's how you perform a transformation in English from an active sentence to a passive sentence. So that's maybe a good chart to remember as far as what's actually happening there. Give a good graphic portrayal. Some people relate to graphic pictures like this. Other people just relate to the words. Whatever is the most convenient for you is fine. Just try to remember what happens. Yes, Mark?
What is the significance of his plus and minus here? Is he showing that the object and by must stay?
Yes, they're one unit. In other words, the by plus x0, that is indicating they're one unit. The other, the minus, I think is just a dash. It's just indicating a separation there. But the by plus x sub 0, they go together, they function together as a unit. And that'll be especially important too, even in Greek, because that preposition plus the object preposition, that's about the only rule of word order you have as far as Greek. You can change those elements all around, Greek word order wise, in Greek. It's not so much as so important in English, because your word order is relatively fixed in English anyway. But in Greek, those things must stay together and function as a unit. Of course, that's true in English too, but it's more obvious in Greek. Okay, the applicability of this transformation may be readily tested. So let's try a few examples. The boy ate the cake. Okay, the passive transformation will take boy and we'll slide it over at the end, put it after the word by. We'll take ate and convert that to passive and make that was eaten. And we'll take cake and take that from the object position, put it in the subject position. And we end up with the cake was eaten by the boy. So we get a passive transformation of this active sentence. Okay. Now, if the transformation is applied to sentences containing pronoun subjects or objects, the case forms of these must be adjusted. Because even in English, you see something analogous to case forms as far as the pronouns are concerned. Let's look at the example here and you'll see what we mean. I saw him. That's your active sentence. Now, the passive is not him was seen by I. If you say that, you know, you'll get in trouble with the grammarians and so forth. So you need to transform these into the proper case forms as well. So I gets converted to me, and him gets converted to he, because it occupies a subject position. In other words, with our pronouns, even in English, we do have a sort of a case-ending type function. And we have different forms of the pronoun, third-person masculine pronoun, he for when it's a subject, and him if it's an indirect object or direct object. So I saw him becomes he was seen by me. So that's one thing we need to maybe take note of. And I think he's giving this as kind of an introduction to what's going to happen to Greek, because Greek is going to change case endings regardless of the words that are involved. We heard her becomes she was heard by us, not her was heard by we. You see, if you just do a straight transformation of word order, you're going to get in trouble here. You have to change the forms in order to make them appropriate. Okay, any questions there on these transformations and what these charts mean, what these symbols mean? Okay, now section 118, now we get to the Greek. As we have seen, many Greek sentences share a structure which has a structural meaning similar to the English structure of sentence 1. There are also Greek sentences which share a structure similar in meaning to the English structure of sentence 7, in other words, the passive forms. Moreover, the former class of Greek sentences is related to the latter class by a transformation of precisely the same kind as that which we have described in this lesson. Greek sentences of the first kind may be represented by the formula x sub n, v active, y sub a, where the n represents what?
Nominative
case, right. And the a represents accusative case. So that is the grammatical device in Greek that's determining subject and object. Now, word order can vary, but the noun is going to be in the noun and the nominative will be the subject, the noun and the accusative will be the direct object, and your verb will be active, in active form. So that corresponds to that formula in section 116, formula A in the English. Now, in formula alpha, X and Y are nouns or pronouns, and the subscripts indicate nominative, accusative case, and so forth. We've all gone through that. Now, when a Greek sentence with structure alpha is transformed in the same way as we have described for English sentences, We do, first of all, A, the verb is changed from active to passive. So we have a passive verb form, which in the Greek is going to involve a different ending system. B, X becomes the object of a preposition. In most cases, this is hupo, which in this function requires that X be put into the genitive case. So your normal pattern in Greek is to use the preposition hupo. Now, we haven't talked much about prepositions, hardly anything at all about them yet. We'll be studying them as a separate group in a few chapters here. But we'll be introduced to, this is our first preposition, let's say, that we'll be introduced to, hupo. And this preposition is often translated by, sometimes under, and so forth, depending on the context. So hupo with the genitive case. As it turns out, hupo takes the genitive. It governs, when we say governs the genitive case. In other words, if you're going to stick a word in a position of being the object of the preposition hupo, you'll have to put that word in the genitive case. So that means that what was our originally the subject, the X sub N, now becomes X sub G, or a noun in the genitive case, following the preposition hupo. Then Y becomes a subject and is therefore changed from accusative to nominative. So the thing that was our direct object and hence was in the accusative case now turns into the nominative case. And so the structure of the resulting sentence is therefore beta, Y sub nominative, in the nominative case, Y in the noun in the nominative case, verb in the passive, plus hupo, plus the what was originally the subject, now in the genitive case. So it's quite analogous to what we saw in English, the major difference again being word order is not a requirement, but case ending is the thing that's going to be the thing you're going to watch in your transformation. Yes, Mike?
Do you suppose that this similarity in structure is due to the intrinsic universal meaning of the passive? Would we expect to see this kind of thing happen in every language, or is this due because of English being a derivative of the Greek?
Well, it's a hard thing to say. I think that any language in which, you see, with Hebrew, with all the languages I'm familiar with, I'm not familiar with all languages by any means, but the ones I am familiar with represent a pretty good assortment of the types. Now, when you get into your giant Chinese and Japanese and this type of thing, you might be in a different ballpark. I don't know. Anybody here may or may not know anything about that. But as far as the Semitic languages are concerned and as far as what's called the Indo-European languages are concerned, I think you're going to see this. All the languages I'm familiar with operate this way. Those of you that from Switzerland in German, do you see the same kind of transformation there with the passive? And since you have case endings on nouns, are they going to convert the same way?
Yeah.
What about, do they use the genitive for the, in other words, when you convert the subject, is that going to go to a preposition with a genitive or a preposition with a dative? Okay, in that case, it's a preposition with a dative. Okay. And that's just because of the difference in the what a certain preposition governs, what case it'll govern. But it's the same basic idea there. Yes.
Word order with hupo is going to lock in the genitive.
Yes, hupo is going to have to be right in front of the thing in the genitive. You can't put a lot of other stuff in between there. You're going to lose the continuity. So that's about your only word order rule there. The hupo is going to have to come right in front of its. Immediately precede the what was formerly the subject and now is in the genitive case.
Am I jumping ahead or will the article go after hupo?
Yes, the article will go after hupo because it's a preposition. It's not like an adjective or something like that. Yes, it'll follow. If the noun's got an article, it'll follow immediately after hupo and before its noun. So there's another rule that's involved. You're not going to see a preposition. A preposition will never split up a noun and its article. The only thing that'll ever split that up are adjectives. Or perhaps a genitive phrase, you know, that's functioning like an adjective. Something that's functioning like an adjective.
But after the preposition, you can still have a whole bunch of other adjectives and stuff in the...
Yes, oh yes, right. Sure. Yes, you could have a preposition and a bunch of adjectives, then the article and its noun. And there is another thing, too, that I almost hate to tell you. But there is a situation in which a prepositional phrase, a whole phrase, may function like an adjective. And you may see to, hupo, to, you know, theu, something. You see a whole prepositional phrase function like an adjective. So you will see some funny things there, but aside from that, it's, you know, when those things happen, they're not really an exception to these rules. They're just a whole phrase functioning like an adjective is what's happening. So we'll watch for that. But as far as this agency situation, as far as this type of structure is concerned, you may see some adjectives modify the noun or something, but you're never going to see something where the article comes out before you po or something like that. That won't happen. Not if it's functioning this way. Okay. A few minutes left here. Look at the transformation diagram at the bottom of page 95 now with the Greek. Now, of course, in the Greek, the word order can vary, so these lines can get all crossed, you know, if you changed your word order as well as this. So they're preserving English word order here just for the sake of seeing the transformation. But realize that a word order is not so fixed, and the only thing that's really required is that the hupo come before its noun. If you actually were to trace this out, you may find any word order there for the active and any word order for the passive. These lines could get all tangled up. So you have to really watch your case endings. That's the thing you've got to keep track of when you're making this transformation. So to go from an active sentence in the Greek to a passive sentence in the Greek, take the thing that was in the nominative case in your active sentence, regardless of where its order was. The thing that was in the nominative case is going to be converted to something that's in the genitive case following the preposition hupo. The verb that was in the active form is going to be converted to a passive form. And we haven't looked at the forms yet. We're going to be doing that in the next section here a little bit and in the next chapters. Then, the thing that was in the accusative case, which was your direct object originally, is now going to be found in the nominative case in your passive transformation. Any questions on that? Okay, let's look in section 119 at some examples. And here he's doing sort of an inductive exercise again for you to inspect these forms and come up with a paradigm for the present and imperfect passive forms. So let's look at the examples here. And he puts some bold in the verb forms in boldface to help you out here. The transformation is applied to a number of Greek sentences below, with the English equivalents given in all instances. The Greek verb forms in boldface are those of the present and imperfect passive. Okay, sentence number one, ego luo ton doulon. I am loosing the slave. Now, of course, they've used the pronoun form ego here primarily just to help you out as far as the transformation is concerned. Of course, we normally wouldn't see ego on here. And luo would be sufficient, but it gives more emphasis. Okay, so ego is our subject, nominative case. Luo is an active verb form, and ton doulon is the accusative direct object. Now, to make this into a passive sentence structure, first I'm going to take ego, that was formerly my subject, and I'm going to make that the object of the preposition hupo. And so that becomes hup emu. They're using the accented forms primarily in situations like this. And there's a note down here at the bottom. I can't remember where they tied it. Well, I guess it's just a note, period. Note one, the accented forms emu and su are used after hupo. So you really wouldn't know that. That's just the way it's done. They just normally use the accented forms. So hup emu. Now, you might notice something else unusual. The O on the end of hupo is gone, and you see an little apostrophe taking its place. This is just a contraction. Instead of saying hupo emu, they just say hup emu. When you've got the following word beginning with a vowel sound, they don't like to have two vowel sounds like that. This is such a common expression. You so commonly see it that they just contracted it. And so it's hup emu. Okay. Now we also have to take what was formerly our direct object, ton doulon, and convert that now to the nominative case, because now it's going to be the subject of our new passive transformation, so it's going to be hodulos. And then the verb form luo is going to have to be converted to a passive verb form. And as it turns out, that verb form is luetai. Luetai. So see, we have a new ending. The stem is still the same, lu, but now we have etai instead of o. So epsilon tau alpha iota is your first person, it's our third person singular verb form. Now here's another thing we have to watch out for, something we didn't see so much in English, I suppose. And that is that in sentences in which you have both, you know, a mixture between first and second person, first and third person, and so forth, you're going to see a person change in the verb form as well. You see, when we started out, we had ego, luo. I was the subject You see, and luo was going to have to be a first-person verb form. But now, in the passive sentence structure, we have a different subject. Now the subject is ho doulos. And so the verb form is going to be not a first-person singular, but a third-person singular form. So we're having to change the person as well, because the person and number have to agree with the subject. And we have a new subject now. Okay? So we've got a lot of transformations going on here. Yes. Yeah, English does the same thing, sure. It's just that the forms are not, don't change that very that much in English, so it's not as always as readily seen. And usually we do it automatically. Yet, in Greek, it hasn't become necessarily fully automatic yet. So that's why we have to pay attention to this as well. So always double check when you're doing passive transformations. I would always recommend double check that verb form to make sure that it agrees in number and person with its subject as well. Because the subject is become, see, in some cases you might have the original subject was singular and the direct object was plural, and now that becomes the subject in the new sentence. You may have a change in number as well as in person. Next example, su lues hemas, you are loosing us. Now you see, us is going to become the subject of our new transformation, and that's plural, whereas the you was singular. So we've gone from singular to plural, we've gone from second person to first person here in this transformation, as well as transforming, you know, all the cases and the verb from active to passive. So, I mean, it's almost an utter transformation from with every word in the sentence. Well, we're out of time here, so we'll stop here. Tomorrow we'll look at these examples some more. No formal assignment for tomorrow. We haven't finished talking about this yet, but we may want to look in class tomorrow at some of lesson 16 as far as setting the paradigms for, and we'll probably do that in class. We don't need to do it at home.